And at this time, if y'all would, let's please make welcome our speaker for tonight, Bill C. from Greensboro, North Carolina.
John said he's going to be brief for that introduction, but I was kind of hoping for a little more color than that. Thank you, John. John and I had dinner together with others tonight. It's been a delightful time, and we're honored to be here. My wife Kay and I have just been treated wonderfully, and it's just been a perfect weekend. I've enjoyed so much, Joe and Kyle, and I just hope I live up to what my predecessors have done. My name is Bill Crawford, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've never, I've had the privilege to come to Georgia. Georgia has a lot of things, and I've just had the honor and privilege to come down and share at Georgia things. I've never been here to the Altoona Roundup, and I'm honored for that. I've never been to Cartersville. I have been wondering where all the trains were. They're here. You have to time it just right, Shug took us on a tour of the town. He knows this town and its history thoroughly, and it was just a wonderful experience. But I remember we had to time the train. I had to rush across before the train got you. Because these are not short trains down here in Cartersville. A long train. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm to tell my story, as you've heard the other speakers do. It's what we do. In Alcoholics Anonymous, when asked to share, I'm not here to teach or preach or to lecture or do anything to make you learn anything. I'm here to share my experience, to share my story. And the first thing that I have is what you have, if this program is working in your life, is the gift of desire. We hear the traditions read. We hear our preamble read, and we know there's only one requirement for membership in this outfit. And it's a desire to stop drinking, and it's something that no one could give me. It's something no one could explain to me, teach, or whatever. It's something that has to be, in my opinion, in my experience, a gift from God. I know that we've all had people in our lives that are dear to us and we care very much, and we've tried to give them that gift, and they just can't get it. And I don't know why, and you don't know why, but I hope I know how blessed I am that I've been given that gift. And I hope you know how blessed you are that you've been given the gift of desire. And if you are new and don't know what desire means, look it up in the dictionary. It's not a little word. It's a strong word. You just don't go off, out in the parking lot and desire. It's... Unless you're with somebody, that desire means a powerful, powerful motivation and need. It means lust. It means a strong, strong need to be satisfied. And therefore, because I was exposed to people like you in rooms like this for long enough, I get it. I know what this thing's about, and I'm not a quick study. I'm not one who picks up on things real easily and real quick. I'm hard-headed. I'm opinionated. I have my defenses out about a lot of stuff, and it's particularly back then when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But somehow in time I get it. I know that what that book says, the point it's trying to drive home as much as any other thing, is this thing that we call alcoholism is primary. It is not caused by something else, that if I can just get straightened out, I'll be okay. It's a primary condition. And if I treat it as a primary condition, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does, I am in a safe place. I am in what we call recovery. Now, for those of you that have never been in a Baptist church before, I'd like to show you that's a baptistry back there. So if anybody's so moved, we can immerse you. Like we do at the churches I've come up in. And I was raised in a home with a dual problem. We had alcoholism and Southern Baptism right there in the same house. And I know that I'm not unique. That happens in a lot of homes that we come up. And once an hour, you know, once a Baptist, you always a Baptist. You can convert to Buddhism, whatever you want to do. But if they wake you up in the middle of the night, you'll talk Baptist. It's always it's always in you. Now, we make fun of or make light of our religious homes and the religious training, but thank God for that jump start. What I learned at my mother's knee, you reminded me of when I came here. Those same truths. It's just that you brought it to me in a way, you put it to me in a way that was understandable to me and receivable by me. My father was an alcoholic. He was a gentle and kind man. He was not a profane man, even when intoxicated. But still, we had the humiliation, the embarrassment, the insecurity that goes along with alcoholism in the family, even though he was not a physical threat. It's just those things that the power of alcoholism, and I hope I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I came up feeling kind of strange. I hear this so many times when people tell their stories in meetings like this. Feeling different. You know, nowadays they have all these diagnoses for children. I got a grandson that's diagnosed ADHD, ADD. Okay. They didn't have those initials after names back when I came along. I came along before Ritalin. I came along during paddling. Which was the drug of choice. And I would determine to be okay and determine not to get in trouble and not be sent out in the hall or have to stand by a tree during a recess and this kind of thing or not be spanked. And I just couldn't live up to it. So you know that part in the big book that Bill writes, we sought lower companionship. I was doing that in the second grade, not consciously. But in some way, if I look back on my behavior, on my actions, on my attitudes at a very young age, I was finding those people most like me. And as I got older and puberty struck, and I began to inhale those lucky strikes, and I became a cat. Young people don't know what a cat was, but this was way before hippies. Well, when you see Elvis tonight, that's kind of the cat image, you know, with the oil in the hair and the duck tail, and we had draped pants, you know, big knees, and it draped down to a very small cuff, and shirt collar stood straight up. And I remember I had sort of a hair problem. I had fine hair. What little hair I've got left now is real fine, and you put just a bottle of Wild Root cream oil in there, and it wouldn't hold any. I remember my cat advisor told me about pomade, which ended my hair problem. Then I became an official cat because the pomade, you know. You know, the Final Net ad that they have on TV where the lady just has a hectic day and she's pooped at the end of the day, but every hair's in place. Pomade would hold your hair for 3 months. Pomade had to grow out. If the Cartersville train hit you and they found your head, every hair would be in place. Which has nothing to do with anything except this was the gang up in front of Manzo Henry drugstore where we were smoking the cigarettes and this kind of thing. And this is where peer pressure outweighed my fear and guilt that I associated with beverage alcohol. And I began to drink. Now, a lot of you don't understand social drinking. I do. I had a social drinking period for about 6 weeks. As I define social drinking, I was a social drinker. I take a swallow of this or a half a can of this, and I tell you what ended my social drinking. One night, I was 15 and a half years old, Charlie and Sonny and I were at the downtown cemetery, the Green Hill Cemetery there in Greensboro, where we'd go for privacy, for all kinds of things. We were drinking cheap wine, and I felt for the first time intoxication. I knew the effects of alcohol. And anything like social drinking, anything like drinking with impunity, anything like drinking like normal people do, left me that night. It did for me what it does, according to the experts, to only a small percentage of people who experiment with the drug alcohol. Most, this varies a little bit depending on the expert, but most agree that about 10% of people who experiment with alcohol get something special from it that other people don't get, that will later maybe cause problems. In other words, it's what it does for us that gets us in trouble with it. It's what it does to us, I believe, that hopefully it will get us here or some form of help. But it did for me what it does for this fairly small percentage of people. Or the way I like to put it, 9 in 10 waste every drop they drink. Now, we know that, I know that, you know that, because they're all around us. They're 9 to 1. We work for them. A lot of bosses are, of the 90%. We marry them. We're bad to live next door to them. I mean, this is everywhere. And they can't help it, and we can't help it. And we can't understand them, and they can't understand us. They've done all kinds of experiments. Grants have come down to investigate this illness that we call alcoholism. They have killed countless rats, given them seizures and things like that, and just studied us. And in fact, I ended up in the field for a while. I worked and made my living for over 25 years in the field of alcoholism and later on in other forms of addiction. And I went to countless schools, workshops, because you had to keep up your hours, to keep your certifications and licenses and all this kind of stuff. And the study, the great energy of mind, the great amount of money that's been invested in studying our condition is countless. Not one penny, to my knowledge, has been spent studying them, the non-alcoholic. And most of us in the room know that they confuse us a lot more than we confuse them. So I tell you what I've done. I'm married to one of the worst cases of non-alcoholism you've ever seen in your life. So I've sort of used her as a control group, and I've studied her. Well, she'll drink a couple of times a year. We'll have our anniversary or something. We'll go out and she'll drink a glass of wine. In the past, when we were very young and we were dating and early, she would consume enough to feel it. You know what she does? She stops. Now let me say that for the newcomers again. She gets the pilot lit and stops. Somebody should have looked into that a long time ago. That demands research. So I've asked her, why do you do that? And she says, because when I begin to feel it, I feel as if I'm losing control and I don't like that feeling, so I stop. Isn't that funny? The only thing that gave me any semblance of control was the same stuff that makes her feel out of control. She can't help it, and I can't help it. To be a candidate for alcoholism has to do something for you. And it did something great for me. I don't have to tell you about it. You know. I can't explain it to people in the 90% category. You already know that at some point in your drinking, it did the magic for you that it doesn't do for most people. And I began to drink, and I had the guilt and fear associated with beverage alcohol that didn't go away. But the need to have regain that feeling, to have that assurance that that feeling was going to come on demand, was greater than anything that would cause me to resist this stuff. And what happened to me is what happened to you if you're an alcoholic. And it's already been said at this conference, we're so much alike, it's uncanny. I can know you and meet you and have only known you for 5 minutes, and you and I can relate on a level that my wife and I cannot relate on. And we've been together 50 years. That's the commonality that we enjoy with each other. So my story is like your story. Now, sometimes we get all bogged down of, you know, who went to jail how many times and how many DWIs and whose liver fell out and all that kind of stuff. Those are just byproducts. What happens is the stories that you see in the big book in the description. Dr. Silkworth was a scientist. He was a scientist that did not set out to do a scientific study on us, but he treated thousands of us. And he made certain observations. And he saw that these people are different. They're not just stupid. They're not just careless. They're not just lacking in morality. They're different in a way they can't help. And the first thing he noticed was the physical difference, the physiological peculiarity. Now, he did say politely that these men and women drink this stuff because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Let's get that out of the way first. They may say they love that good martini or margarita, or they like the cold beer when they mowed the lawn, but they're drinking it for the drug effect. They're drinking it for the effect produced. But he said, what is baffling to me, but it is there. It's a phenomenon, and a phenomenon is just something you see, but you just can't explain it. And he saw this thing in them and couldn't explain it. They have a craving that other folks don't have. They take a drink, and they start craving more and more. It's irresistible. Now, long before I'd ever heard of the doctor's opinion in Silkworth or AA or whatever, I knew that craving. I knew if I were in a situation that I could only get a drink or a couple of drinks, I better be careful because I was going to feel worse, be more agitated, be more craving than if I didn't have any at all. Even if I was in a situation where I wanted to drink pretty bad, the phenomenon of craving. I begin to lose control of the amount I drank. That's alcoholism. Kay, I'm going to try not to bog down with a lot of drunk stories, but since we're so close to Atlanta, I thought I'd mention that I've been in Atlanta a lot of times, and certainly in the program, but previously I've been in Atlanta. I was down here. I went to work for a company. I was down in Atlanta for a school. I was a new employee, and it was an orientation school. It lasted a week. First night, I ended up in the Atlanta City Jail. The other new employees did not end up in the Atlanta City Jail. But I did, and I just didn't end up quick. They'd put us up at that time at the Cox-Carlton Hotel. I was in the wee hours of the morning trying to get back to the Cox-Carlton Hotel. Summer evening, summer morning. Long, arduous, and I was disoriented. You know the feeling when you finally arrive and at that time I just slept in my underwear and you get undressed and you just lie down and go to sleep. That feeling of relief. And I had that. The only problem was I had not made it back to the hotel. I was on the front porch of that building across from the Fox Theater. Now this is back in the 60s and maybe Atlanta wasn't as cosmopolitan and sophisticated as they are now, but a group of yuppies had sort of formed a circle out there looking at me, I guess, because when dawn broke, it was 7 o'clock in the morning and the sun was up. And the police and what we used to call the paddy wagon was there. And he was handing me my pants and loaded me in, and I'm in the drunk tank. And I have to call that school for the people of that school to come bail me out of jail. And I'm in the vice president's office, and he's giving me that lecture, and that signal, that radar that we have, I know in a few minutes he ain't firing me. That he's just lecturing me and warning me. And I made it the rest of that week in that school. I didn't stop drinking. I made it the week. And at the end of the week, a young man came to me and he said, "I'm from Greenville, South Carolina. You're from Greensboro, North Carolina." He said, "I'll help with the gas if you'll let me ride with you as far as Greenville." And I said, "Well, if you'll drive, if you'll do the driving." So I climbed in the passenger side, and he drove, and we're heading out onto 85, and I reached under the seat and got that brown bag out, and he looked at me like they look at us. And I remember what he said. He said, "You really like that stuff, don't you?" And I forgot what I said, something macho like, "Yeah." And he told me a story. A story I don't know why I remember. I know now why it struck and stayed with me. I didn't realize it then. I couldn't appreciate it then. But he said that when he and we were both about 25 years old, he said to me he had drunk alcohol to intoxication, and it was a fraternity party, I think. And just went crazy. He tore up a bathroom or something. It didn't sound so bad to me, but it was just a horrible thing to him. And he said, "I found out that anything that would do that to me, I would never touch again." Now, I could have regaled him with some horror stories that would have made his hair stand on end. I had made that promise to myself many times. Now, there were two guys in that car about the same age. We were in the same situation, working for the same company, going through the same school, probably had the same demographic at home, probably married with 2.1 children or whatever you're supposed to do. But the difference between, and as a matter of fact, we were so much alike, neither one of us could tolerate alcohol. Neither one of us could drink. He knew about me. He knew that I had gone to jail. I embarrassed myself, humiliated myself, and almost got fired. And he'd admitted his intolerance, his inability to have alcohol. But the difference between us was beyond any mutual understanding. Neither one of us could drink, but see, I couldn't not drink. And at 25 years old, I knew that. I'd made all kinds of pledges, all kinds of promises, come up with all kinds of plans. I couldn't not drink. Sometimes it seemed like I could. I'd go a week, sometimes 2 weeks, longer. But the time would come when I would drink again. And not only did I lose control of the amount I drank, I lost control of my behavior. My behavior became unpredictable. My behavior became antisocial, unacceptable. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't just because I had hit a few inconveniences. Things were bad. I was not an anonymous drunk. People knew. Anybody who knew me knew I was a drunk. Anybody knew who knew about me knew I was a drunk. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the lower companions no longer wanted me. I'd been kicked out. I was kicked out of places I wouldn't be caught dead in now. I'm most proud of the Bamboo Lambs. The Bamboo Lounge is where the lower companions congregated. Let's put it this way, you don't notch down from the Bamboo Lounge. Once you've been kicked out of the Bamboo Lounge, that's kind of it. It's not a scale lower that you go to. And I couldn't go back there. I was not acceptable among the unacceptable. Now, all through this, I'm married. I'm married to Kay. How we alcoholics do. We want leave people alone. If we'd go off in the If we'd go off in the woods and progress by ourselves, we'd probably wipe this disease off the face of the earth. But no, we marry and have children and create a family disease. And I've done that. And for some reason, and often she tells her story and she tries to explain it, but for some reason she was still there. And she still cared. And our home was the sick home of alcoholism. You see, when alcoholism exists anywhere, but certainly in a home, in a family, it sickens everybody. Nobody's unaffected. And so I'll tell this one story since it's some fresh faces, and I swear I'm going to get sober and we're going to eat ice cream and see Elvis. I tried all kinds of things. The insanity has already been described to you. Joe did a fine job of describing the insanity of this disease. That's what kills us. And I tried all kinds of things. I can remember I was working for this same company that had sent me to school, and I was, at that time, I was wearing three-piece suits and wingtip shoes and couldn't pay the rent, but I was image conscious, and I was subscribing to the Wall Street Journal. I was that kind of guy. Yeah. And I was sitting in the office reading Esquire magazine because people like me read Esquire magazine. And I opened up and it was a double page ad for some sort of, and I don't remember the brand, but it was some sort of famous sour mash whiskey like Jack Daniels or Rebel Yell, something expensive. And it didn't have a pretty girl in there or a guy with gray and temples or any of that kind of thing. It just had a picture of a glass with crushed ice and a green fluid in it and a leaf sticking out, and it said mint julep. And at the bottom, it gave a quick and easy recipe. It said to make a mint julep, you use a jigger of this Rebel Yell or whatever. It's a jigger of creamed mint, and you add mint julep. Now, it occurred to me that I'd never heard of anybody having trouble drinking mint juleps. Think about it. It's a gentleman's drink. You never see in the paper, man arrested drinking mint juleps. So I said to myself, if I drink mint juleps, now this is not the only thing like this I'd done. This is number 200. Nobody could accuse me of alcoholic, inappropriate drinking, drunkenness. And it was a Friday, and I stopped by the liquor store and got a bottle of that cream de mint. I'd never tasted it. And I couldn't afford the Rebel Yell, but I got some George T. Stagg, and I came home and Kay gave me that look like I was going to drink and get drunk. I said, no, tonight we're having mint juleps. And she wasn't going to have it to be party to it. But then we were living in an apartment complex where a lot of young couples lived, and they're out in the courtyard with a couple of the ladies, and want a mint julep? They said, yeah. This was long before I'd even knew about ice crushers. I shouldn't have one, but you could wrap a dish towel, remember that, around some cubes of ice and beat it up with a hammer. And I beat me up some ice and filled up, you know, ice some glasses with crushed ice and jigger this, jigger that. Went out there and they sipped on theirs. I finished mine first. I went back and beat me up another one. This was back in ice trays, too. Some of you young people have never seen an ice tray. That ice... See, she thought I was going to get drunk. And I was sipping mint juleps. I knew that now I finally found a way that, you know, I didn't even particularly like the taste, and I knew that made it safer, you know. I beat holes in that dish towel with a hammer. So what I discovered is you didn't really have to beat it up. You could just put the cubes in. Jigger the cream de menthe, the jigger of the bourbon, just as good, just as chilled. Might write the company and tell them, you know, you don't have to crush the ice. But if you got ice trays, you eventually run out of ice. So I ran out of ice. And I found out warm, you could put a jigger, you know, a little splash of this, a splash of this, just as good, warm. About midnight, I lost the glass. And the darndest thing, you could take the bourbon and take a slug and chase it with the cream of it. And it mixed just as well. And see, the whole time she thought I was going to be drunk. So I've got green teeth and green lips. I'm down to my own underwear by then, and I'm lecturing her if she'd just sit down and have a few drinks with me. Well, I'm going to get sober here. I'm going to shut up about this drinking. It just, the time comes, we hope to God we hit that wall. Now, it was the middle of summer of 1966. I was 28 years old. I was working for a crooked company at that time. I'd flown back in from St. Louis with this company. She picked me up in the airport at the lounge, tapering off. An art I never perfected. Now, all alcoholics understand, I think, tapering off. It's kind of self-detox, isn't it? It's a fine line. Kay could never tell the difference in tapering off and drinking. It looks a lot alike. And sometime I would overdose tapering off, and that would add to her confusion. And it would just be a mess. You know, from a three-day drunk, I'd taper off for another week. So she brings me home. I get to my drinking uniform, my underwear, and I'm, for some reason, some sort of desperation was upon me. And I'd done all kinds of things, and I don't have time, nor do you have the patience to hear about it, to get this monkey off my back. But this time I looked in the phone book and found Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called AA. And AA in Greensboro at that time just hired an answering service that answered for an oil company and a veterinarian, and we just wanted a customer. And a guy by the name of Bill Norman called me. I had the privilege of eulogizing in his funeral about 6 or 7 years ago. But he called me, and he got the call, the lucky Bill. And then we chatted for a while. And by then, you know, I'd had her stop and get some more beer. And he was about as narrow-minded about tapering off as Kay. He said, "All right, you're drinking." "No, well, not really. I'm tapering off." And he didn't want to rush to my aid. But I had his name and number. And Kay was out of the house with the children somewhere. And when she came back to the house on this hot July afternoon, you know, I had the ammunition. I had his name and number. You know, I just kind of hush. I've turned myself into the ANA, and this is the man's name and number. He and I agree I'm not ready yet, but I'm going to call him when I am. Now, a month went by, 2 months went by, some time went by. She went to that safe place where that name and number was. And she called. She had been doing things too. She had been reaching out. She had been going to places and people to try to find an answer to this. But she reached a strange man on the phone and heard a strange voice and began to tell him what was going on in our home and was talking for the first time to someone who not only understood, but who offered a solution. Now, she wanted what every member, family member of an alcoholic wants, every loved one, anybody who's still there and still cared, fix him. And he was honest, "I can't fix him, but let me let you talk with Lib." And Lib got on the phone and told Kay about Al-Anon. Now, if you are drinking alcoholically and your significant other, as they say nowadays, gets into Al-Anon and starts following the Al-Anon program, it probably won't cure your drinking. It's not designed for that, but it'll break your rhythm, I'll guarantee you that. You see what happens? The game changes. Somebody needs to get better in that sick situation. We're all pointing at the drunk. You know, let me take you to the back bedroom here and fix that drunk. But somebody just needs to change the game. I credit Al-Anon as much as anything to getting me to the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went every Wednesday night. And probably more, but I knew about Wednesday nights. And when I would listen, she'd tell me about Bill and about Lib. It was on June the 2nd of 1967 when she looks at me and I'm coming off another one of those drunks, and it's no different. It's no different from the 100 before. This damage done. this fear, and I'm sick, and I'm the only person in the world. And she looks at me and says, can we call Bill? All she had to do was say Bill. I knew who it was. And she dialed the phone for me and handed me the phone. I never will forget what Bill said. He said, are you about ready to throw in the towel now? And I said, I sure am, because I sure was. I'd hit that wall. My bag of tricks was empty. I didn't have options. My schemes and plans were gone. If I'd had another lie, if I'd had anything, any delay tactic, I'd have used it. It was a fairly late hour on a Friday night. He agreed to come see me that Saturday morning on June 3rd, 1967. He came to that little house. I was about to lose. The payments were $100 a month, so I wouldn't make them. And Cameron Brown was going to sell it on the courthouse step. And Bill came in the living room of the Big Shot's house, and he began to tell me about him. And he was generous with information about himself, and he acted like he cared about me much. And at the end of that session, he said, let me just ask you to agree to two things. Don't drink today. Can you do that? And go with me to Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. If I had anything up my sleeve, anything, I'd have used it. Now, I was still cool. I didn't want the AA van pulling up in front of the house. I said, I'll meet you there in case I don't like it and I want to be able to leave. Kay and I met him at the Starmount group. That's my home group today, that night. It was a speaker meeting like this, a fraction of this size. There were probably 20 people there that night. And after the reading that I didn't understand, somebody climbed up and told the story that we tell, the miraculous story that we tell. I've been to countless speaker meetings. I never tire of it. I never tire of the miracle that's imparted from podiums like this. You know I'm going to give you a happy ending, don't you? Now, tomorrow night I may go to a meeting and the guy will say, I never made it, I'm drunk right now. But thus far, and that's what he did. Now, I couldn't repeat it a single sentence he said 5 minutes after he said his talk, but miracle number one was I understood his message. I knew that he said to us that he had drunk alcohol hopelessly and that he'd come here and he hadn't been drinking and life was good. I knew that's what he said. But the real miracle, the real hook, was that I believed him. And I hadn't believed anybody or anything in so long. I couldn't remember. And they rallied to me. You know how they do after the meeting. Nobody, when you've been kicked out for life from the bamboo lounge, and you don't have to tell anybody you're new. They knew I was new. And in case they didn't, they aim that cake at you. You know, that's a test. And you go, no, no cake for me. I don't like sweets. There's a new one. Yeah. Coffee makes me nervous, you know. How fast our bodies heal from that high blood sugar from the alcohol. You know, a week later, I'm spitting cake crumbs on somebody newer than me, and I'm loving the stuff. But what began my recovery? Now, Alcoholics Anonymous, by definition, every meeting we go to, it was read beautifully tonight. Alcoholics Anonymous, by definition, is a fellowship. It is this community. It's what we experience with each other here tonight. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is, first and foremost. If you'd have said, well, we're going to mail you a book, you do what it says and you get kind of straight and come on down and see us, I'd have died. What happened is this shaky, one day sober, only person in the world, fearful, rageful person sat down in the middle of you on that Saturday night, June the 3rd, 1967, not understanding what was going on. And it began to work. And like I say, I had a gift of desire. I don't mean I had insight. I don't mean I had any sort of self-discovery or whatever. I mean I had desire. I wanted something different from this. Now, I hope we still tell people to stick with the winners. But the winners at that time stuck with me. They surrounded me. And this was back doing this 12-stepping, and I'm not trying to play old timer or say it was better then than it is now. I don't mean that. It's just back then we did a lot of 12-step work. We went to bad neighborhoods, good neighborhoods, cheap hotels and nice hotels and just all kinds of places. Picking up drunks, taking them to the hospital, emergency room, trying to get them a little paraldehyde or whatever. Yeah, and it worked. I don't mean any drunk met us at the door and said, "You got some steps I can start working," but it worked for us. And this is how I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is how I came in. These winners, they're all older than me. Back then, if you came in at 29 in 1967, that was young. Thank God that's changed. But I was young, and these men were older than me and flattered me much with their attention to me and their inclusion of me. Now, if you've been kicked out for life from the Bamboo Lounge, your nights are free. You know, I've worked with a lot of guys, have sort of checked their calendar about getting a meeting. You know, I got soccer on Mondays, and then my nights were free. My calendar was empty. So I went to a lot of meetings, and I can remember Bill said, "I want you to go to a meeting every night." And at that time, there were only 11 meetings in Greensboro. Now there are 111, I guess, but only 11 meetings in Greensboro. 9 groups. Central met 3 times, 11 meetings. And it was they were all 8 o'clock. There were no such thing as noontime meetings or morning meetings. Not there. Not then. But I'm going to let you take Sunday off. Don't go to the Sunday night step discussion meeting up at the club, because, see, there's a couple of screwballs there that'll confuse you. I couldn't wait to sneak off to the Sunday night step discussion meeting. And the two screwballs weren't hard to spot. One came to a very tragic end. He tried to kill his wife, and he did kill himself some year later. The other one, we don't know where he went. But I began to tell them about being an agnostic. Shared with them. All AA groups just dying for an agnostic to share. See, not everybody in there was a screwball. A lot of people there cared enough about me to say to me, "I used to be like you. I felt the same way. I had the same disbelief. I had the same doubts." And they would say simple things to me. In the group and in the coffee pot afterwards, they would say, I would do things. I'd get up in the morning and I'd say, "Let me have this day without a drink." And when that worked, whether that's coincidence or otherwise, I would say, "Thank you." That's how they begin to pray. And that's how I begin to pray. Now, y'all had taught me the serenity prayer, so I found myself saying that. This old agnostic. Praying. And then I learned that with that come and believe, I learned the most beautiful prayer that I still know today. That third step prayer. A prayer I've used 3 times or 4 times today. "God, I offer myself." You don't even have to use King James English. You can say, "God, I offer myself to you. To build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self so I can better do your will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them will show others your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always." Greatest prayer I know. Because what's killing me is self-centeredness, selfishness. That, we think, is the root of our problem. Sat down and did a very weak inventory at the beginning. That most of what I put in that inventory, I'd probably tell a stranger on a street corner down in Cartersville now, but I thought it was a big deal at the time. Then somebody said, "No, there's one in the big book that might interest you. Why don't you do the one in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I knew what resentment was, but I didn't have resentments. Who would I put down? Well, explain, well, you hate everybody. Just put everybody you know. Oh, okay. And that's the realization. You know, it's 2 of the most powerful sentences in our book. It's right after we do this exercise. We begin to see the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. Strong language. Lord, I thought that putting that extra proof in that vodka was doing that. Or slipping up mixing that scotch with beer. No, you see, you are dominated by other people. You're dominated by this world. You're dominated by the situation, particularly people. And I begin to know, when I told that story to someone else that first time, I begin to know the relief of sharing that. Now, if you're new, and I always say this, especially if it's a new crowd, if you're new and you're holding back on the fifth step, or you're holding back certain information, you know, I'll go to a grave, my grave with a couple of these secrets. I'm not telling anybody these things. Now, the big book says we can take it with a priest or a lawyer, a doctor or whatever, but times have changed. We got these old crusty sponsors we can take this fifth step with now. And you can't shock an old crusty sponsor. Or if you do, he'll never admit it. So I say, if you want to test it, go to your home group and go over there where the old timers are standing around the coffee pot and just blurt out the worst thing you can think. Doesn't make any difference whether you've done it or not. Just think of something awful and blurt it out. I ate a live rat one time. Nobody will flinch. They'll nod. One of them will probably say, I used to do that. You're not going to shock anybody. Or if you do, they'll never admit it. They're not going to be topped. They're going to throw something back at you worse. That great relief of not having any secrets. I have a sponsor now. We just met for lunch last week. And he's the one I have no secrets from, in thought or deed. He has to hear it all. And he not only has to hear it all, he's willing to hear it all, and he loves me in spite of that. I can't live with secrets. I know the things, the manifestations of self. I know the things that I can ask God to take away. And if I'm not ready, the book says, never say never. Our 12 and 12 says, never say never. Be willing when you can. How do we clear up the final wreckage of the past? You know, we make those amends. And if sometimes all I can say to Kay is, all I can say is, I'm sorry. That doesn't make the amends, but I will live better. I'll do better. And to some extent, I have. I don't mean I'm wonderful, even good, but she tells me, you are a different person. And I'm a different person because I had to become different to have these things. Now, I had credit cards when credit cards were wonderful. Back in the old days before computers, you could run with a credit card a long time. The oil companies mainly, besides Diner Club, it was mainly oil companies. Texaco, back then it was called Humble Oil. And I owed them a lot of money, and I wanted to write them a letter and say, I'm sorry. No, you got to pay them. That's what amends it. Let me tell you what this does, what the freedom is when you clear up this stuff. See, I have to give up all hope for a better past. That past is there. But that past can be turned and put into God's hands and become my greatest asset. Let me tell you how that works. I do these things. I pay off Humble Oil and I pay off Texaco. And I do the things that make it right so I don't have to change sides of the street when somebody else is coming. And I'm not afraid to answer that phone anymore at the front door. And every ugly piece of my past can be used to help somebody else. Now, things have got to be kept simple for me. So as I go through the day, I have to realize, hey, I'm getting out of whack. Well, what's causing me to be out of whack? What's making me uncomfortable? Just four things. The program says it's going to be dishonesty. It's going to be fear. It's going to be anger or selfishness. And it's mostly selfishness with me. My sponsor says, you want to know if you're back in the self again? Or are you going around mad all the time? You're back in the self. You taught me to pray here. You taught me how to ask God for what He wants and the stuff to do it. The payoff of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we talk about we get our jobs back and we get wives back and we get a little money in the bank and we're healthier now and enter the marathon or whatever we do and this kind of thing. But the payoff is the is the freedom from that selfishness just a bit at a time. You know, I was sitting someplace with somebody doing something. Maybe I was emptying ashtrays at the time and spending some time with some jerk that was worse off than me or newer than me or scarier than me. And a new and wonderful feeling overcame me. And I realized later that just for a couple of seconds, I cared more about someone else than I did me. And that had never happened to me before, drinking or not. Good friend of mine in the program gave me a book. It's not AA stuff. Doesn't have a circle and a triangle on it, but it's written by a good friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's full of little stories. And my favorite little story is about the ancient holy man that's kneeling to pray. And as he kneels, he sees the broken and the beggar, the hurt. And he says to his God, if you're such a loving God, why haven't you done something about this? And out of the silence, his God answers him and says, I have done something about it. I've made you. And that hits home with me because I know that he made Bill and Bob. That's what he's done by this ugly thing, about this ugly, insidious thing we call alcoholism. But beyond Bill and Bob, he made you. And I've got to remember every day of my life that he made me. Thank you.
Small token here. I can't talk anymore. But anyhow, that's what it is.
Beautiful.